Thanks for coming today to our session, Lean Forward with Windows 10 Deployment Experience of a TAP Customer. My name is Joseph Parody. I'm a senior director with Avanade, and my teams are responsible for all of the infrastructure and enterprise services at Avanade.
So I'm Dennis Tran. I'm a workstation architect at Avanade. I work for Joseph, and I'm responsible for our Windows 10 deployment and SCCM app deploy.
So we're going to start out with giving you a little bit of context of Avanade. As we go through the presentation, there are going to be aspects of our company that are going to be similar to yours and aspects that are going to be different. And so we want to get a little bit context out there. Avanade is a technology and management consulting company. We're owned by Accenture and Microsoft. So we work in the Microsoft ecosystem exclusively. We're in 24 countries around the world, and we have about 10,000 workstations that we support. Now, we are a little different in that the vast majority of our users are not in one of our offices. As a consulting company, I want my users to be at my client, helping to serve them and helping them to be successful. So that means that our primary scenario for supporting our users is somebody who's remote, somebody who's not on my network, who's on, in essence, the internet. So that's a little bit different, but as we go through, we'll talk a little bit about how we support that. And we think that for many of you, that will become a primary scenario more quickly than you might expect as you start to have users who may not be in your offices anymore, or you may not have offices anymore as you get more work from home scenarios. We started with Windows 8.1, but as of yesterday, we're over 62% on Windows 10 globally within our environment. We're going to push with 1607 to try and get to 100% on Windows 10 by the end of the calendar year. So let me talk a little bit about what it means to be a TAP customer. So one of the things that you do as a TAP customer is you're always testing something new from Microsoft. So on the right-hand side, you've got the circle of life that you live as a TAP customer, where Microsoft releases a new build, you go ahead and upgrade your TAP users to it. You'll either be participating in specific scenarios that Microsoft has defined, or you're testing some of your own scenarios. And then you see if it works, you give some feedback, work with the team on any bugs that you find. Next week, you come back and do it all over again. So that's kind of what the life of a TAP customer is. And there's some interesting advantages, right? So we get to see the builds of Windows 10 before anybody else. So we're kind of like the insiders, but the corporate version of the insiders. We see most of the same builds that the insiders do. But the nice thing is that we have the ability to give feedback to the product group in a very direct, tracked way. And so we can talk to the product group about how the build or how that feature works for an enterprise customer, which is going to be different than the average Windows insider who's more of a either small business or a consumer customer, right? So that's the advantage of being a TAP. Now, you might think that that sounds great, you know, maybe we should do it as well, but I want to let you know there's some cautions here, right? There's a lot of time and effort to participate, right? That when we're in the heavy TAP build testing cycle, we're not in that right now because 1607 just released, Dennis and I spend a chunk of our day doing TAP work that we don't get paid for, right? Microsoft doesn't pay us to participate in the TAP, right? So it's a business decision that our leadership has made that this investment is worth it for our company, right? We get to have fun with some of our builds, right? So, hey, you upgrade to a build, now all of a sudden I can't connect to something that's critical. Guess what? Now you get to re-image your machine, right? So Dennis and I live with multiple machines all the time on our desks, one running the latest TAP build and one running something that we can use in case that TAP build goes bad and we have to attend a critical meeting. Sometimes we've had security issues in Windows that are in that TAP build and there's not going to be a fix for it. So we may have to wipe that machine because we can't use that. And we don't allow people outside of our TAP testing team to run builds because of the risk to our data and our clients' data, right? Some of you in this room are maybe clients of ours, right? We won't put your data at risk. We get into interesting discussions with the product groups about sometimes things that they change. The product groups sometimes have some great ideas, at least in their minds. We don't always agree with that. So we get to be in some discussions, and sometimes it doesn't go our way, right? So they'll change a feature, or they'll change the way it works between a certain build of Windows and another build of Windows, right? Or between the way it worked in 8.1 and the way it works in 10. And we need to be ready and able to deal with that if it doesn't go our way. So I'm going to hand it over to Dennis now, and he's going to dive a little bit deeper into some of the aspects of Windows 10.
Right. So we looked at all the different features that are available with Windows 10, and there's lots. And we've listed a couple of them here, kind of in two silos when we evaluate. A lot of them look, hey, good and easy, the press releases, the online documentation. Great, we want that day one if we can. But when you take a deeper dive in it, some of them actually requires more thought and more evaluation before we can actually deploy it, or maybe actually doesn't even fit our organization, or we're not ready yet. So we're going to take the next couple of slides to cover some of the ones we thought were valuable and get a sense of how we evaluated the different feature set. So Windows Hello. Anybody we've talked to who uses Windows Hello say it's magic. I mean, it works really well. You sit in front of your machine, it automatically signs you in, and you're ready to go. But, well, that's great, and we want to deploy it to all our devices, and where are all those devices? So Surface Pro 4 and the Surface Book are the only two devices that have that Windows Hello supported camera. Right? All the other ones, all the other vendors you have, all the existing webcams aren't compatible. So now you're stuck. I want to use it. I can't. So there is an alternative, right? You could use the Intel RealSense camera, but that's big, that's bulky, that works on your desktop. So if your environment has desktops, that's something you could do to use Windows Hello. But if you're like us, which is all mobile or all laptops, nobody wants to carry that around. And you gotta plug it into an external, you have to plug it into a USB 3.0 port because it actually draws a lot more power. We've tried it on a docking station, it doesn't work well. It wants to be directly connected. So that may be not a good option. How about fingerprint reader? Windows Hello with biometrics. If you have existing fleet of devices that have a fingerprint reader, it's compatible. It's ready to go. Right? A gotcha for that, as you know, we get more and more devices with fingerprint reader, is drivers. If you're using older drivers with the fingerprint reader, we're getting situations where we see it can't recognize your finger. So making sure you have the right drivers. And that's critical for our deployment as we deploy Windows 10, is getting all the right drivers on the device that's supported by the vendor, that's known and good and working. Now, we always have to think about security. So we look at Windows Hello, great, you don't use a password, automatically signs you in. Well, it does require a PIN requirement to set up. And you know, that's a bit of a problem. On our phones, sure, a 4-digit PIN is fine. Maybe, well, security doesn't think it's fine for us because they want an 8-digit PIN. Now, for my workstation, maybe I don't want a 4-digit PIN. I think, you know, with four numbers, they have full access to my machine and corporate data. Well, you can actually secure that by using a PIN requirement. So on screen there is a group policies that you can set regarding PIN complexity for setting that up in order to get Windows Hello. For us, we've set up 8-digit PIN, uppercase, lowercase, as well as special characters. We didn't apply the 60-day expiry or expiry to the PIN or a history, because we feel that for Windows Hello and the setup of this PIN, it's really secure on the device and on TPM. Well, I don't need it to expire on all the devices or reset it or have that history. So that's what we've set. Maybe that's not right for you, but something you can consider when you set up Windows Hello. So Cortana is something we feel that there's a lot of potential for it in the enterprise. Think about what if it can key in a database source for your corporate information, enterprise search, you know, support. I can get help without picking up the phone because Cortana can know that information and help me, right? Knowledge articles, how to fix problems. You know, so it's got a lot of capabilities that we think we can take advantage of, but at this time, in our opinion, it's really not ready for the enterprise. In the consumer space, it works great. For us, we have a lot of concerns. So I've listed here some of it. Right? The first one is, of course, syncing across multiple devices. When you use Cortana, you need to use and sync with your Microsoft account. Well, that means information about you on your corporate device now be synced to your personal one, because it's your MSA account, it's not your corporate one. Right? And that's a problem for security and possible data leakage. So it's a challenge for there, as well as, you know, enabling and using Cortana in the enterprise space. Well, we're global, so we have people with different regions, different language settings, all set up on their computer, and Cortana is actually only compatible in 13 different regions. I'm in Canada. Luckily, I am one of the regions that's supported. However, I still have to install language packs and additional packages to enable Cortana. That kind of sucks. So, you know, it's a challenge even for us. And if you're using SCCM, getting those packages onto the machine, it's not that simple. Right? In our example, in our test, when you have SCCM enabled for updates, downloads of any packages within the UI doesn't know how to reach out to Microsoft Update to actually do the download. So it's not easy to set up. It's difficult and challenging if you're in a global environment. So we don't think it's ready for our enterprise use. Now, the good thing, of course, is Windows as a service. As the product matures, as Microsoft is listening to our feedback, they're putting in these improvements. So what we do know is Microsoft is working on allowing syncing with your Azure AD account. So your Office 365, you can turn on Cortana syncing. You can get all that working. And from a data syncing perspective, it's going to be synced with your enterprise Azure AD creds. That's a lot more secure. Same thing with the feedback around how to enable Cortana on the devices. They're looking at allowing different settings, different regions. Well, in Canada, yeah, I speak English, but let's say I want to put a different language, but I want to keep the region as Canada. They're looking at doing that, making it easier for our enterprise users to use Cortana. So if we go back to today, not what it could be, right? I talked about the challenge about allowing our users to download the packages necessary to enable Cortana on the device for different regions. So here's an example of enabling Chinese on a device. There's multiple different language packages that they require. Now, this is all in the MVLS ISO package for language packs. You extract the ones you need. And then what we've done is we've packaged it up and made it available over SCCM. It's very simple to use the DISM command, right? A couple lines there, and you can install all the packages on the device. Now, something that I kind of note in our testing, I didn't put the no restart command line switch there. What happened is it installed the first one, it prompted me to reboot, and then it didn't install the rest. So make sure you note to put in the slash no restart. And then for detection method on this, I didn't put it on screen, was detecting specific files on the system. So I used file level detection to make sure all the language packs are properly installed. Enterprise mode was something which was key to our success in kind of moving faster and kind of stopping or removing the blockers around compatibility on the browser. So any websites you have, any web apps that, let's say, are using Silverlight, third-party add-ons that are related to the browser, well, if it doesn't work with Edge, that's okay. We can make it work with IE11. Right? So out of box, the site list, you can easily manage where you want to direct your users if they want to use the Edge browser. Right? You can do sub-level site listing. So avnod.com is going to open an Edge. Let's say my intranet.avnod.com or go.avnod.com, any of those, I can say, well, I need that to open in IE11 instead. And that's very easy to configure. So easy, quick win. The implementation is quite simple. And let's say that website, that web app, or our third-party vendor add-on is suddenly, well, we're compatible with Edge. Great. I update my site list. All my clients will realize there's a new version. They download. And when the next time they open that site, that app, it's going to open in Edge. So I think it's very valuable, easy to implement, and you can go with it today. As we get on to security, this very, very exciting topic, I'm going to throw it back to Joseph.
Thanks, Dennis. So you've heard this week, probably in other sessions, about security and Windows 10. And I want to focus just a moment on what we think is one of the most important security features in Windows 10, and that's Credential Guard. Today, the vector of attack in your enterprise is not likely to be the firewall or an application that has a vulnerability. It's likely to be your user's credentials. They're going to get those credentials, they're going to go across your environment, and they'll eventually escalate to admin. So Credential Guard is one of the single most important things that you can do to protect against this threat vector. We believe that Credential Guard is something that you should do first on your high-value targets, right? So we're rolling it out for all of our IT administrators, right? Anybody who is a domain admin or another type of admin within your environment, those are the creds you want to protect the most. So that's where you start rolling out Credential Guard. Now, I know that in the session that Rob Lefferts did, the general session on Monday morning, there's a section that they showed that all you have to do Credential Guard is turn on this one GPO. Well, let me help you dig under the covers of what it really means to turn on Credential Guard, because it's not just that one GPO. So it's tied to certain versions of Windows, right? Only Windows 10 Enterprise and Education can do this, right? So if you're thinking about that debate between Pro and Enterprise, and there's a bunch of other features that you only get with Enterprise, this is one of them. So this is something that you want to think about. It also requires configuration on your machines, right? It requires secure boot UEFI. It requires Hyper-V role to be turned on. And it requires you to be using the TPM. So as you think about this, think about, hey, should Hyper-V be turned on in our image? Should that role be turned on in every one of our images? Don't set up virtual NICs. Don't put on switches. Don't run people in virtual machines. Just turn on the role, right? That's something that you can do as part of your deployment to be ready for Credential Guard. In our deployment, we have a check to see whether Secure Boot UEFI is set up in the BIOS. And if it's not, we stop, right? So the technician can make that change in the BIOS, restart the deployment. And now we have our machines there. So we have existing machines that are on legacy BIOS boot. It's going to take us some time to find those, ask people to come in, get re-imaged. But that'll help us to get to Credential Guard. So I have a link here, which is probably the best link I've ever seen that helps you to understand. There's links on Dennis's slide as well. One of the things as we go through this presentation that we want to try and do is not only share our experience, but share information that you can use when you go back to your offices to help you deploy Windows 10 faster. So think about the foundational elements in order to get Credential Guard, because if you start with those broadly deployed, then you can start implementing Credential Guard for your high-value targets. So another topic that you hear a lot about from Microsoft is this evolution away from domain join to Azure AD join. And we think that this is really the future. We think that this is going to enable that digital workplace of the future. But again, we don't believe that it's ready for enterprises yet. We believe it's absolutely viable for small businesses, for some other scenarios. But for enterprises, we think there's some gaps. If you've been doing this workstation stuff for a while, right, you've come to appreciate the power of group policy and SCCM. And you can do some amazing things with group policy and SCCM. We have a tree structure of OUs with GPOs that apply at different parts of the tree, with WMI filters, right? Intune doesn't have any idea what a GPO is, right? So the scenarios that you need in an enterprise just aren't covered yet by Intune. And we need that additional control and security. Now, the good news is, Dennis and I, in particular, are involved in talking with the Intune team, helping them understand that gap to be able to satisfy enterprise requirements, helping them to understand the need for something like group policy, And how do we get from where we are to where we want to be, right? Because if you've invested years of building out your group policies, you don't want to reinvest that because there's some new technology within Intune. So we're going to be working with Microsoft to help them make that bridge across the gap that exists today between Azure AD Join Intune and what we know and use with group policy and SCCM. So let's talk a little bit about 1607, or the anniversary update that just came out. And I want to highlight some of the quick wins that we saw in deploying Windows 10 1607. The number one quick win, I talked about it in Rob's session on Monday, but it's device registration, right? I'll go into a little bit more depth on a next slide, but device registration has really been super simple for us after we got the foundational elements in place, and a big win for our users. Edge, let's say we weren't so big fans of Edge when it first came out, right? Edge is a great idea. It's a great first step by Microsoft when it came out in the original version of Windows 10. But it didn't have the stability. It didn't have the performance. It didn't have what you needed to replace the browser that most of your users want to use. Well, with 1607, the feedback from our users is Edge has now gotten there, right? They're able to say, I'm going to use Edge as my primary browser, and that works for me. Are there a few things that maybe they would like to see enhanced? Absolutely. Microsoft is working on that. But one of the nice things is that because Edge is a modern application, they're revving Edge on a regular basis through the cumulative updates. So you start to see new features and bug fixes in Edge more quickly. We also got some advanced settings. The GPOs in Edge, when Windows 10 was released, I think there were like 7, right? And IE, there were 385, right? I don't think 385 is the right number, but 7 is not the right number either. Now we have more, and we can control more of those things. The other thing for us that was a big win, you may not think this is even interesting, but it's offline Defender Scan. If you think about what I said about our workforce, right, they're all remote. If I had somebody who has malware on their laptop, it's been identified and through Defender, reported in through SCCM, security team contacts them, and we think it can be removed by Defender, I can either ask them to take 2 days away from the client, travel to the nearest office to get it fixed, or we can say, hey, start an offline scan after restart. We have the command line to do that. And then that gets you the lowest level scanning and fixing from Defender. So this enables us to reduce client downtime when we have a malware incident. And I know we're different. None of your users have ever clicked on a malicious link and got infected with malware. So I know this doesn't apply to you, but I just wanted to share. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what device registration is. So device registration is, the way that I describe it, is it's kind of Kerberos for the modern world, right? So if you think about it, device registration is this notion that your domain-joined workstation is trusted by your domain. And because of that trust, it allows you to generate some trust for the user that authenticated to that workstation, right? And in the modern world, what that means is an Azure AD OAuth token, right? So with device registration, once it's registered, your machine gets an OAuth token for the logged in user automatically. That can be leveraged in Edge or IE. Note I didn't say Chrome, but they're adding that support if Chrome is your chosen browser, right? And then when you go to Office 365 web apps, or you open up Outlook for the first time on your machine, single sign-on. That's a huge win for our users, right? Because one of the challenges when you start to live on the internet and you live with SaaS services is NTLM doesn't exist, right? But your users have spent years loving the single sign-on experience of NTLM. So how do you get that? Device registration. So in order to implement it, it's much easier in 1607. In 1511, you had to set a GPO. And then once the GPO applied, your user had to sign out and sign in twice, separated by a minimum of 5 minutes. So you can imagine how effective that is, right? They're like, hey, it doesn't work. Hey, it doesn't work, right? In 1607, they've made that run in the background now, right? So within about 5 minutes of you deploying the GPO, device is registered, user has the token, right? Much, much nicer. Now, I do have to caution you. If you're running ADFS, ADFS 3.0 is, I believe, the minimum supported. There is some configuration you have to do to get this to work. It can be complex if you have a complex ADFS setup. So for us, we have a multi-domain ADFS setup. Microsoft support was able to help us get the script that's published online modified so it worked in our environment correctly, and now it's set up and running. I can't imagine going back. I've been using device registration since we first piloted it with 1511. It's just now it's part of what we do. And that's the same thing that your users are used to. It's that single sign-on. So not only does it work with Office 365, right, but many of you are using Workday or Salesforce or ServiceNow through Azure Active Directory. Now you get that single sign-on for those as well, because this is an Azure AD thing, not an O365 thing. So you're able to enable your users in this new world of a services-based economy much easier. And they're going to like that, whether they're in the office or outside the office. So I'm going to turn it back over to Dennis to talk a little bit about how did we actually deploy Windows 10 at Avanade.
Right. So we spent a lot of time here talking about evaluating and planning. How did we actually build it? What did we actually roll out to adopt Windows 10? So we have two ways for our users to get Windows 10. We have our full image, which is a traditional MDT captured image, WIM, and all that. Right. We can do it with light touch. We can remotely image with a USB. We also offer in-place upgrade from 8.1 to Windows 10. That's using SCCM App Deploy. Right? It keeps your files. It's a lighter impact on the user, and it keeps all your apps and everything, handles BitLocker, so it works quite well for us. Now, both of these are offered to our users in a self-service. So we're enabling our users to do this on their own, because they're remote, or they have client engagements, deliverables, they have a timeline too, and to be productive, they may do this on a time that's there, that it's available to them. Now, even for our self-service, right? If you think of MDT, we have a tool that allows them to download the image, it creates a bootable USB stick, plug in, reboot, tap F12, follow deployment wizard, and the image goes away, and it starts imaging the machine. About 30 minutes, they're up and running. They sign in. We have DA running. We have everything ready to go. So, you know, for us, it works that we need that remote connectivity, you know, be able to image remote, be able to upgrade in place remotely. And that may be not necessary for you guys. And you guys might have other options in terms of deployment. So why MDT? Let's dig a bit deeper on there. Right? It is a bit of work from our operations side to build that image, and we do it monthly. Put our updates in there. We do CUs, driver updates. You know, it's easy for us because, well, we did it in 7, we did it in 8.1. But as part of TAP, we saw what was coming. We want to try the new stuff. We want to see if we can have a new method of deploying Windows 10 on our workstation, maybe get away from that. But every time we evaluated some of the new features, there were challenges that were very difficult to solve. For example, how do you get that clean image? Right? All the apps that come with your OEM installed machine, each one is different. I'm sure you have a variety of different models that you get. How do you actually clean all that off of it? Certainly Microsoft is working on it, but it's not ready when we deployed, and it's still not ready today. What about BitLocker? Right? We need it at AES 256 for encryption. So let's say I take a Surface Pro 4. That's pretty clean. But it's Pro, you get to Enterprise, and you find that BitLocker is encrypted at 128-bit encryption strength instead of 256. So for us, we need it at 256. How do you get there? I got to fully decrypt the drive, make sure it's 100% decrypted, and then re-encrypt with the right cipher strength. Now that's time and effort from our technicians to do. It's time and effort if we tell the user they have to do it. Right? We have that scenario of BYO as well. Well, now your user has to take care of that. And drivers have been a critical part of the quality we get when we image and use a machine. We want the user to have the best experience, and drivers are part of it. Right? For Skype for Business, quality, call quality over wireless, the top reason that they get bad call quality is bad wireless drivers. We've stuck with the Intel because we know that it's better than the other options out there, but we still make sure it's using the latest driver. There's also automation. We want it to be efficient. So I talked about how we can image remotely, 30 minutes, they're fully done, right? And that's part of automation. They didn't really have to touch the machine much. They can sign in, and they can be productive. And that's important for our organization, right? As our users are down, they're not productive, we're losing money. So we want them to be able to work ASAP, and we'd rather spend the time from the operation side to get a fully working image than saying, hey, here's a set of instructions on how you get yourself up and running. So this image anywhere kind of concept, because for us, we need to be able to achieve that. Our user can image from a hotel, from this conference, anywhere, it doesn't matter. And there's a lot of ways to do it. We found that the remote domain join piece is the key part. MDT, if you have remote domain or if you have domain join in there, you have to be on-prem. A couple ways to do it, you can script it with VPN. What we've done is we've used djoin.exe. So this is supported in Windows 7 and up. I was supported on Windows 10. A lot of flexibility, lots of options you can do with djoin. Right? So we have a web service that takes calls. Right? You call the web service and say, I need a new machine joined to the domain. It calls and connects with our domain controller, generates the computer object, creates an offline djoin text blob that they send back to the client. The client applies that with djoin.exe. And then after the reboot, they're domain joined, right? And we can say, okay, let's package, you know, certificates in there. Let's say I want group policy. So that's what we've done. We've put into the DA text our group policy for direct access. That means when they're rebooted, they get the policies with direct access. They can continue to get stuff from our server. They can sign in remotely. They don't have to do a VPN connect to sign in because direct access will take care of that. Now, if you want to take it further, there are a lot of options. So there is a TechNet article on how you can configure djoin and all the different slash options that you need. Talk a bit about our in-place upgrade. Now, when Microsoft told us, yeah, we upgraded all our machines, you know, to Windows 10, we were a bit skeptical. We did the 7 to 8 upgrade. We did our 8 to 8.1 upgrade. It wasn't that good. Right? Performance impacts that we saw on the machine to us weren't acceptable. In certain cases, right, apps weren't compatible. Apps didn't perform well. I can't believe I had to uninstall, reinstall Office going from 8 to 8.1. I mean, that didn't make sense. And it's more downtime for the user because they can't use their productivity suite. So there's app compatibility issues. And then we also faced a lot of problems with failed upgrades. We had users who tried the upgrade. Well, they're stuck in a black screen. Right? Drivers weren't compatible. They'd have to get their data off, rewipe. Well, that's more time that's lost. But with 10, we feel the quality's there. For all the machines in our pilot group, 1,000 of them, they all in-place upgrade. It worked well. Right? For the issues that did happen, it rolled back so that they'll be back on 8.1, they can still work, be productive, they can try again later, they can call support and look at what actually happened. Right, so restoring the previous build was good. They have a readiness checker for app compat that you can use. So we think Microsoft got this right. Right, so kudos to them for the effort they spent on getting upgrade working and working well. Not to say it's perfect, right? So for the machines that we noticed that did roll back, it was mostly related to BIOS. It was related to having, you know, a VPN connection that wasn't compatible. So the readiness checker will help there. But overall, we think it's solid. It's gotten us to our current adoption rate a lot quicker than before, than telling a user, oh, you got to wipe and reload. Well, no, in-place upgrade, right? Least impact to the machine, retains all your data, your app, and it's quick. In under an hour, they're upgraded, they can sign in, and they're ready to go. So the way in which we provided in-place upgrade is via SCCM app deploy. Now, maybe OSD works for you guys because you're on-prem. For us, we're everywhere. So having it as an app deploy, our users can access it over Software Center, SCCM, they can download from anywhere. And SCCM has a pretty good, solid suite of features in handling application management and deployment. You can apply a lot of controls and flexibility because you can set, okay, well, who do I want to deploy to? I can create a collection of users. Well, maybe I want to be a bit more fancy. Let me check with all the users that are part of an AD security user group. Everybody knows how to add people to an AD group. That's pretty simple. SCCM can actually check and sync with the AD group and pick up all the users in there. You could do a group that's machines and say all these machines can get Windows 10. Great, right? You don't have to go back to SCCM. Set up a query, query the AD, and you'll get everything added to the collection. You can schedule it every day. You can schedule it every other day. It's totally your call. You do get some control in terms of requirements as well. We have a lot of devices that are not Windows 10 ready because the vendor has specified that they have not done any testing with that model on Windows 10, and they have no supported drivers. I'm pretty sure we can upgrade and make it work, but that doesn't give us our quality, doesn't give us our best user experience. And what about vendor support? They call the vendor and say, hey, this machine's not working. The first thing they're going to ask, well, what operating system you got? Well, I'm on Windows 10. No, that's not supported. We don't test it. Here's our disclaimer. Too bad. That doesn't help. So we can do global conditions in SCCM to check, okay, for this model, no, you're not going to get Windows 10. It's not available to you. We're not going to try and install it. Right? And you can create OS. Let's say I don't want those users on a specific OS to upgrade. Right? That's all possible through SCCM global conditions. You don't need to know how to code to do it. It's very simple to do global conditions. So what I have on screen here is just a quick WMI query on the model information on your laptop. And then as part of my app deploy, which is the second screenshot, I've listed all the models. We've whitelisted all the models that we know are working well with Windows 10. And it's flexible. I can say, well, we have issues with the 7440. Let me take it out. Okay, it's updated, and it's ready to go. And the global conditions are also very flexible. If you want to do the advanced stuff, you can do PowerShell check. You can do any query you like, BB script. You can do registry check. You don't actually have to code to do it, but you could if you want to. When it comes to the actual deploy, we actually didn't do anything too complicated. We took the full ISO. We made it a package, application deploy, uploaded the content, we made it available. Right? And in our testing, for the install, all we did was set up .exe with auto upgrade. Now what you should see here is also, we didn't use the UI. When we did use the UI, because we like it, we don't want no UI, because that means it installs in the background, and it's going to force reboot their machine. Okay, they lose their data. That's really negative user experience. So we wanted a UI. And we had it. We used the basic setup.exe UI. And some feedback that we got from support was, we got some users who called in and said they upgrade and they're not domain joined. They don't have BitLocker. All their apps are gone. So what happened? Well, apparently as part of the UI, you can choose. You could still choose. It presents it. Even though I have the command line switch to do auto upgrade, the user could actually pick and choose, oh, I just want to keep my files. Or I want to keep nothing. So they chose that. And what happened was they're in an unusable state, and now they had a reimage. So instead of showing the UI, I've disabled that. Right? And we replaced it with something we've custom coded. It's actually a very simple app. It pops up on screen with a message we can customize. It's got our branding, so the user doesn't see it as malware. We still get some calls about it like malware. And then it runs just the command line switch in the background. Not very difficult to code. If you don't want to use .NET or that type of coding with a UI, you could do PowerShell prompt with a message box. simple as that. Right? They click install, and that's when the install happens in the background and it reboots their machine. You could also do no reboot if you want. So install it, push it. It'll install and pre-stage in the background. And when the user decides to reboot, that's when the upgrade occurs. And we're seeing that on the consumer level. If you have Windows 10 at home, that's basically what happens. It's downloading all the updates, and you restart, you get that experience of the upgrade, and you're there. So that's something you can produce as well, just with the no reboot command. So when we look at kind of servicing, we have our traditional desktop deployment. We've done it in the past as well for Avanade internal IT. Right, moving from 7 to 8, 8.1, it's a long project. It is a project. You've got to key in all the different teams, security. We've got to work through that process, readiness, change enablement. There's a lot to it to actually get an OS out. Now, with the cadence of Windows releases, can we actually keep up? By the time we get to the end of the process of the project, I got the next build, so now I got to repeat. Right? How do we work more agile in deploying Windows 10 and consuming Windows 10 as a service? We want those new feature upgrades. We want to be up there. Although for us, maybe a bit different, because we're a CV shop, because we want to be using the latest, greatest. We want to push that boundary. Maybe not for you guys, but you still want to try and keep up. Because in, 6 to 12 months, it'll be CBB. You're going to look at the next one anyways. And that's a lot of effort. So we want to try and come up with a method where you can adopt a lot more quickly, a lot more efficiently, and keep up with not just Windows, but with all the other products. Now we find there's a way in which a model to work that will help support us moving faster and at a lower cost and kind of minimize the impact it would do. And that's about our digital workplace, right? Moving to cloud services. So there isn't that much of a dependency on what my on-prem resources or app compat. Everything's just consumed online on the cloud, right? So self-service is something we have. We have our users. We're enabling and empowering our users to go to Windows 10. They can do it themselves, right? So that's reducing some of the support overhead we need to have support help desk, work with our users and move people there when the user can do it themselves. Right? Engage your employees. I think that's very important, right? Our group of pilot users, a group of insiders, that's what we call them, we talk to them. Right? They're the ones in the field being productive, getting the revenue. Well, we don't want to impact them that much. We want to balance. We want to hear their feedback. We want to get this out right? So engage them will help kind of move this forward. And they'll be okay with the change. And they'll embrace it. That's what we hope for. And then always think about security. If you think of each box there, if we consistently think of security, just like we did in evaluating all our features, we don't have to wait till the end. Oh, OK, so what's all the security problems? We've thought of it at each step. So when we get time to deploy, we've already mitigated a lot of the risk when we're going live in production or pre-production. So here's a bit of a picture around our digital workplace and our ecosystem. And it's worked well for us in being heavily on the Microsoft stack. We don't have a lot of third-party apps or vendors. So that reduces our app compatibility issues. Right? We're a BitLocker. We don't have to deal with full drive on third-party encryption. Right? The idea of being connected anywhere. They can be productive as long as they have an internet connection. Right? They're getting the latest features and all that from Microsoft. So there's an advantage, and kind of I talked about Windows as a service, us moving more and more to the cloud. We're there. We're achieving that. It's doable, and it works. And it works well for us to be quick and agile. I'm going to let Joseph talk about our amazing insider rings.
Thanks, Dennis. So one of the things that allows us to move at the speed that we do, right, and to really live Windows as a service, is that we've adopted the ring-based model that you've seen from Microsoft, right? And we use that ring-based model not just for OSs, but for everything, right? We use that for Patch Tuesday Windows updates. We use that for new GPOs. We use that for new OSs, for Office, right? And it's a formalized process that we follow around releasing things quickly. So we'll walk through the picture below, right? And I'll give you an example of what we do, for example, with Patch Tuesday, to give you an example of the speed that you can achieve. And I know this because we can achieve it, right? So we start on Patch Tuesday. So after the patches come out, they get loaded into SCCM, and they get deployed to what we call our canary ring, us, right? Our workstations, right? And these are our production workstations that we use every day, and it gets deployed to us on Wednesday. Now, that deployment is the same deployment we're going to use with everybody else in our company. So the team that does that deployment deploys it to us for Wednesday, deploys it to the internal IT department, it's about 100 or so people, with an install required with reboot by Thursday, right? So we'll find if it massively breaks something, and we can pull that patch out. It won't affect 100 people. Now, the 100 people are global, right? We've got people in different countries, running different languages, having different applications. So we've not got that testing by Thursday. The insiders is really a key to our success. The Avanade insiders is similar to Windows insiders in that it's a self-selected group of people who want to live on the edge. So it's not us tapping somebody and saying, hey, we're going to make your workstation less stable. It's people who have opted in. And we've got about 10% of our workforce globally opted in on this. So they get the patches by Friday night and new group policy or whatever, right? So they've got the patches by Friday night. And then everyone else, it's by Tuesday night. So 7 days out from Patch Tuesday, all 10,000 of our machines globally are patched and rebooted because we force the reboots, right? So if you think about this, how would this work in your enterprise, right? You can think about what are the right rings, what are the right sizes of those rings. And in doing this, we looked at the success of Windows Insiders, and we looked at what's happening in the consumer space where companies and their customers or their users are having a different relationship than before, right? We're being more open with our users about what we're doing and them being involved in our testing. And they're responding fantastically to that because that's how they see it in the rest of their life, where they're using lots of technology, potentially more than we are. So when you're moving at the speed of Windows, there's a number of things that you want to think about so that you can stay safe. First one really is group policy, and it's why we're so insistent with Microsoft that any solution in the future has to have the characteristics that we've known and grown to love with group policy. We have a tree of OUs that our different machines are in, and we apply different group policies to different groups of machines. They're very granular. We're big fans of WMI filtering for the group policies, so that we can apply a very specific setting to a very specific build of Windows, or Office, or a region, right? That gives us the ability to have that control that we need. Now, we also need to protect our client data and our data. So we disable certain things, right? If you're on an Avanade image machine, that nice UI element that says, hey, I want to be an insider, that's off, and you can't change it. Grayed out, because we can't risk data from people using unsupported builds from Microsoft. We also use the defer upgrades GPO to make sure that people don't get updates from Microsoft when we don't want them to. Some of you may have noticed that with 1607, Microsoft made available to enterprise SKU Windows 10 the 1607 upgrade simply by going to public Windows Update. You lost control over when your customer went to 1607. And if you had an incompatible AV application, your customer called because they were in a blue screen loop. We figured that out pretty quickly. Fortunately, we weren't affected, but one of our customers was. We found the group policy that we needed to change. We applied it internally and helped them as well, right? So this is something that you're going to find, right? As Microsoft is moving at speed, you're going to have to adapt to it. As Dennis mentioned, SCCM is our second most powerful tool. Again, because of the granularity of control it gives us, we can use SCCM to target devices, target users with the right thing at the right time. And we can prevent machines from getting software that's going to cause an issue. Probably the biggest thing that has allowed us to move at speed is moving towards web-based applications. And I believe that we are over the crest of the hill of people understanding that web-based applications will be the future. And I think it's driven by SaaS. If you're a Salesforce user, or if you're a ServiceNow user, or a Workday user, or any of the other thousands of SaaS applications out there, I'm pretty sure you're not downloading and installing a new version of their fat client and connecting via VPN to their data center to run your app. You're running it in a browser, right? And by running applications in a browser and by leveraging SaaS applications whose companies have a vested interest in making sure that their applications work across a fleet of browsers and OSs, you take advantage of the fact that they will spend that money to make their app compatible with Edge, and you don't have to spend that money, just like in other areas. So SaaS, the use of SaaS applications by enterprises, we believe, will enable you to be able to move fast. And then finally, for your legacy applications in the browser, leverage enterprise mode, right? It gives you that seamless user interaction so that they can continue doing their job and not worry about the fact that, hey, I opened this app in Edge, it doesn't seem to be rendering this thing that I expect, right? Enterprise mode allows you to get them to IE11, which will give them the experience that they want. So let's walk through how we looked at 1607 and how we were able to move at speed. So again, you know, we used in-place upgrade. App compat really wasn't an issue between versions of Windows 10. Had to do a little bit of group policy changes. But let's look at the picture on the right. August 2nd, Microsoft releases Windows 1607. So got the ISO from VLSC, which any of you who are enterprise customers know that site implicitly. And here's what's interesting. Microsoft is realizing that enterprises need not just the enterprise ISO. We need the ADMX so that we can apply those new group policies. That was available on the 2nd of August, right? So we used the SCCM app deploy that we already had. Swapped out the bits, created a new one, right? We didn't have to change setup.exe. We didn't have to change how we deployed it. We had to look at what collections we would use and swap out the bits, change the name on the title. So we're leveraging what we already did in the past, and that's what Microsoft is doing. We put in our group policy changes. There were only a few of them for 1607. And there's a third CU on August 2nd for that build. But we already know how to deploy CUs. We've been doing that for a year now. So deployed that CU, right? So now, literally on the 3rd of August, we were ready to start deploying to test machines, in-place upgrade, 1607 with the CU. And we did it. Dennis and I both did it, right? So about a week of testing later, we were able to release that to our insiders. So now we've got our client-facing people, 1,000 of them around the world, upgrading to 1607 with the patch from the CU, with the group policies, a week later, right? That's something we didn't even dream of in the Windows 7, Windows 8 days, right? You just didn't think it was possible. Now, those 1,000 people are using it, right? They're finding some issues, right? So depending on how closely you follow the issues with 1607, we had four or five people completely lose their machines on the upgrade. Because there was a bug where if you had Hyper-V enabled with a certain configuration, locked your TPM. That was it. You're not getting into your hard drive again, right? And we were able to get into a couple of hard drives by taking them out, slaving it to another machine, getting the recovery key, right? But any of you guys seen those like Surface Pro 4 devices? You want to know how you get a hard drive out of that? With a hammer and a crowbar? Yeah, kind of voids the warranty to do that, right? We had a Surface Pro 4 user, lost all their data, right? So living on the edge, welcome to being an insider, right? We're all thrilled, but we knew, hey, can't release this more broadly then, right? Microsoft released a cumulative update, fixed that problem. Scepter broke PowerShell remoting. So now my entire Exchange admin team is upset with me, right? Because now they can't actually do their job because PowerShell remoting doesn't work, right? Within a few days, Microsoft released another CU. But because we can deploy CUs within 24 hours of their release by Microsoft, that's okay, right? Our insiders were up and running. So had a couple of bumpy weeks there in the testing. But just before we came here this week, we released the in-place upgrade to everybody at Avanade. So all 10,000 people at Avanade can now go to Software Center, Windows 10 1607, go, and they can start upgrading. And I think before we came here, we had 400 or 500. Now we've got 700 and something as of last night upgraded to Windows 10 1607. So now we're working on the image, right? There was a new release of some of the MDT bits with 1607, right? So had to take those. And doing the testing of the image, I imaged the first machine last week, right? Dennis is doing the main testing, but we're imaging machines and getting them out to some of our test users right now. And then by October 1st, we're gonna have all new machines going out the door with 1607 and all users having upgrade to 1607 available to them, right? So within 60 days, 1607 is now our new corporate OS, full up, right? That's what's possible, right? I'm here to say Microsoft is going to tell you lots of things, right? I'm assuming there's some Microsoft people in the room, so forgive me. Not all of them are true, right? There's some really ideal situations that cause it to be true. But if you focus on your environment and you focus on believing that you can do Windows as a service, it is possible. We've done it, right? This is how we work today. And this is how we're going to work going forward. We have changed the norm for how we do workstation releases at Avanade. And I believe you can too. So I want to talk a little bit about how you build those rings. Right, so as we think about how we're doing the rings, the first, you know, somebody applies to be an insider, right? And really, the foundational element of the insiders is an AD group. We add them to an AD group, right? Now, in order to apply new stuff, the machines that that person uses have to be in an OU so that we can do that, right? So how do we do this, right? In SCCM, we sync that AD group. Okay, so now SCCM knows about it, right? We have to create device and user collections based on that AD group. I'll have some screenshots later that you can use when you go back home. Now, how do we get those workstations into that OU? Well, PowerShell's really good at that, right? So we have a scheduled task with small amount of PowerShell code that talks to SCCM, says, hey, what are all the workstations for this user, right? Because SCCM figures out primary user for the workstation. Let's get those names. Let's see where those computer names are. If they're not in the insider's OU, move them, right? And that runs every single day. So if I get a new machine, Dennis gets a new machine, by the next day, it's in the insider's OU, and it's getting the right group policies, right? This is not rocket science stuff, right? You could do this when you go back. We apply all of the group policies to that insider's OU, so now they're getting, you know, for example, the latest version of Office 365 Pro Plus. They're getting all of our new group policies. They've got 1607 available to them. And then we create our deployments in SCCM. So how do you do this, right? So I'm not going to spend a ton of time going through this. Some of you may be SCCM administrators. Some of you may not be. If you're a workstation person, right, and you haven't started learning a bunch about SCCM, I'd urge you to do that, right? One of the things that has been really successful for Dennis and I is that we're both workstation people and we know SCCM really well, right? And so we understand how to use the two together. Let's take questions at the end, if you don't mind, just so we can roll through it, and we'll use the mic so that they can be recorded. Thanks. So with SCCM, you have SCCM seeing the group, right? So here you have group is Avanade Insiders. You run a full discovery, now you've got your user collection, right? So you start with your user collection. So now you know where your computers are. They're in that OU because you've got that task that moves them. So now it's pretty simple, right? Let's create a collection for my devices based on where the OU is, right? Because SCCM knows the OU of that device. Now you have your computers collection. And you might be thinking, hey, Joseph, that's great. But you know, I'm not on SCCM vNext. So this is all going to work for me. That you know, cool app thing that Dennis showed and the other stuff that you're doing, yeah. So we started our Windows 1607 deployment on SCCM 2012 R2. We've been running Windows 10, patching it, deploying it on SCCM 2012 R2 for over a year, right? Microsoft has decoupled the need for an SCCM upgrade from Windows 10. I don't know who else has ever tried this before Windows 10. You got a machine with the SCCM client installed, Windows 7. Upgrade to Windows 8.1. What happens to SCCM? Client's dead. You get to reinstall that client. Except you can't get the software to that client because the client's dead. Right? Windows 10, in-place upgrade, SCCM client is just fine. Keeps running, right? That's a huge deal. That's one of those little details for an enterprise Microsoft got right. It's one of the very first things we tested, right, as part of being a TAP customer. So SCCM 2012 R2 is just fine. It works. It does everything that you are seeing here, right? So you can start today because SCCM 2012 R2 is fine, and then you can move SCCM at the pace that's fine for your organization. Maybe you're using it for servers as well as clients. Maybe you've got some testing that you need to do there, right? That's fine. Move SCCM when you want to move it. So I want to show you one kind of cool thing that we do with SCCM to help us track the progress of deployments. So here's the dashboard that we have. And you can see this. You'll be able to use this query if you want. But we want to understand how many machines are running different versions of the operating system, right? We want to have Windows 10 versus Windows 8.1 versus Windows 7, right? I know there's like 8 Windows 7 machines. What are those doing there? Got to get rid of those. But we also wanted to track the build, right? So which one is 1507, 1511, 1607, right? So we're able to create collections and use those collections for our tracking to see our progress on the rollout of SCCM. We can also use those collections to target the upgrade. So we'll be targeting the 10240 folks to get up to 1607. At the bottom, we're showing we also do this for Office. So we know our 2013 and our 2016 split on Office. And we can target those 2013 people with the upgrade to 2016. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get only the things to the user that the user needs, right? Not say, hey, everybody, if you haven't yet installed Office 2016, please go do it. No, I know who I should target that message to, right? And that's something that, you know, it's the way that we think about thinking of our users as consumers, right? Thinking about how you would do this in the public internet space. So to wrap up, I think it's time to take the leap. If you haven't already decided that you're going to aggressively roll out Windows 10 and figure out how to get to live with Windows as a service, I think you should start thinking about that. And you don't need to be a TAP customer, right? our experience is different than yours because we've lived on that edge for a while now. But what we hope we've done in this presentation is show you that you don't have to be a TAP customer to get the benefits out of Windows as a Service and some of the stuff that we've done, right? Use enterprise mode to get around your app compat issues in the browser. Use your existing SCCM. Think about your collections and rings. Have your own insiders group, right? It will appeal to your users that you want them to be invested and involved with you in moving forward. Leverage the fact that your company is moving towards SaaS web-based applications to reduce your app compat issues. If you have third-party tools for some of the things that are a known issue, full disk encryption being number one, anti-malware being number two, I'd urge you to take a look at the Microsoft products. Microsoft has made, well, number one, BitLocker has been great since the start. So if you're not using BitLocker, that's probably a little bit of an overdue message. But Windows Defender has not had the greatest PR in the past. I'll be 100% honest with you. But those folks on that team have stepped it up. And they are world class now. And they understand that it's important to enterprises that they are world class in what they do in Defender. So take a look at Defender. You will be surprised. Take control of your device drivers and figure out how you're going to get to Windows as a Service. So with that, I want to thank you for attending. Please do fill out your evaluations. And if you have any questions, I'd like to ask you to go to one of the microphones. The session is being recorded, and we want to make sure that we capture your questions and hopefully our great replies to them. Thank you.
Hey. Thank you very much for this great presentation. I have a question. Are your users in your environment running with administrator rights or without?
So today, our users are running with administrative rights.
So how do you deal with applications that they installed on their own? Like, let's say, some picture tool or video alarm player, stuff like that.
Yeah, so there's a couple things, right? First off is we have a support statement around what we support, right? If you're going to install something for personal viewing of ripped movies, probably not going to be something that you're going to call the support desk about, so I probably don't know about it. But I think the biggest thing is what Dennis had mentioned, which is Windows 10 has a command line switch on setup.exe that checks app compat, and it uses Microsoft's latest knowledge of app compat. And we've actually had people say, hey, I tried the upgrade and it rolled back. We're like, well, I don't know. We checked the logs. There's some app they installed. Microsoft knows it's not compatible, rolled them back, right? So it's, again, leveraging that power of the cloud and the power that Microsoft gives you to learn from what other people have done. It's saved a number of our users from massive pain.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else?
I have a question.
Oh, there's one over here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you had you mentioned that you used remote domain join.
Yes.
With that, I noticed that you had like some command line. You also mentioned you could get a lot of this stuff into the domain join text file. What kind of things can you get in there so that when you do that remote domain join that it's ready first time?
Yeah, great question. Dennis had mentioned it, and I want to make sure that we're clear on that, right? In order for our remote domain join to be successful, we not only need the domain join blob, as it's called, but we need a machine certificate. And we need the machine certificate because we need the direct access group policy, and direct access requires the machine certificate. And we need those things because when the machine reboots, if it has domain membership, it has the machine certificate, and it has the direct access configuration, then that machine can set up that direct access tunnel, and the user can log in with their domain creds on first login. And the machine can get group policy updates because it can talk to a domain controller. That is a critical element. If you have a high number of remote users that you need to support, and you haven't looked at direct access, because back in Windows 7, it literally was rocket science to try and get that thing running on UAG. It is massively easier with 2012 R2. and I would urge you to take a look at direct access, at least the computer tunnel part, and see if that would be an answer for your organization.
We talked about having things in different OUs. With Djoin, you can actually specify, oh, I want, if you're going to use remote domain join, to be in a specific OU. And then you can move it later. That's also part of the parameters you can use with djoin.exe.
Great. Got a question over here?
Yeah, I have a question about SCCM. So you mentioned that SCCM 2012 R2 is capable. Is it capable of servicing Win10 in the same way that vNext would? Like, what's the difference? When you say that it's capable, that's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, so it is capable. It's not the same, right? So you're pointing out a great differentiation. In vNext, right, the current version is 1606, they've added features that can make Windows 10 upgrades much easier. If you look at the new software center in 1602, 1606, there's an operating system tab, right? So you can have a much easier experience for Windows upgrades if you're running vNext. So it's a big advantage to run vNext, but it's not a blocker. As we said, we did the app deploy. We have thousands of users who have used that successfully. So we said, yep, that's nice to have. It's not required. Now, there's some other stuff you get with SCCM 1606 sort of in the back end, right? But as the Windows 10 part, that's the key element, is it can make your updates easier within your environment. We do a little bit of that work that we already did to make it work with 2012 R2.
Okay, so just to follow up, so just to be clear, so you can be on current branch for business with 2012 R2 and then take your time to deploy vNext at your own pace?
That's exactly what we did. As a matter of fact, we're on CB, so we're current branch at Avanade, right? We live on the edge and have the scars to help you not have those same scars. But yeah, we're CB shop, right? So we're literally there, right there. And we upgraded our 2012 R2 SCCM to 1606 after we started deploying Windows 10 1607. So we've been doing Windows 10 for over a year on 2012 R2.
Okay, great.
Absolutely possible.
Thank you. Great session.
Thank you. Okay, looks like we have one more.
So you talked about languages and Cortana, and that's something that we've been facing quite a lot of issues with, especially with Asian region and their different type of keyboard layouts and characters and so on. You showed an example where you installed the language packs and all these feature on demand parts of it. Is this something that you typically do for all the countries in order to overcome these language challenges?
Yeah, so let me see, maybe let me make sure I understand it. When we showed that example of the code, right, all of those lines was to get one language.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it hard, right? Because all of those files, they're actually split across two different DVD ISOs that you have to download from Microsoft, right? And so I think there's only 13 languages that we've found where you can get all of the bits to make Cortana work. You've got Cortana half functional, like voice doesn't work, or handwriting recognition doesn't work, or something like that in certain countries. I don't know off the top of my head all the countries that it actually does work in, but we found it challenging because we had to do a lot of testing to figure out what were all those files that we needed for a single language to fully work on Cortana.
But it still works for if you need that display language on the OS, if you're not specifically targeting Cortana, you could do the same package and say, hey, if you need display language and speech, download and install, and that script works the same. Okay. But as Joseph was saying, it just depends on all the packages that are available in that ISO that you can use.
Thank you.
And of course, they changed the way that they named the categorization for that ISO in 1607. So it took us like a week to find where that ISO was in 1607. They said, we released it. We're like, no, it's not there. And they said, we changed the category.
And it doesn't apply to Office 365. So that is the way you need the Office deployment tool to get your different language if you need Office languages.
Yeah, that's different. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
How do you deal with those language packs after an in-place upgrade? For example, going from TH2 to RS1, after the upgrade, all the language packs are gone. How do you get them back, and how do you know which language packs were installed prior to the upgrade?
Great question. So with SCCM, you can download the new language packs and then send them out as an update to your existing machines. I'm not exactly precise on the details here, right? For upgrading somebody who already had a specific language pack, I believe they've now released through SCCM and WSUS the ability for you to just say, hey, here's all the languages I support, send this out to everybody, and if they need this update, apply it. If they don't need it, don't apply it. I think that works.
That was, yeah, when we got to 1606 of SCCM, that's where we saw that was capable. Okay.
Yeah, so that's vNext then.
Thank you.
Okay. We have over here.
Did you have any scenarios with third-party encryption where you went from a third-party encryption utility to BitLocker in your in-place upgrade?
No. If you remember slide one, you see that Microsoft logo, they own part of us? Okay. So we're pretty much a BitLocker shop. Thanks.
Your users go to Software Center to get the 1607?
Yes.
How long do you give them to until you send it out?
Right now we're in complete self-service mode.
Okay.
This fall, we're going to start messaging people, hey, you have to do it, you have to do it. And then at some point, we're going to say, hey, countdown timer, you've got 2 weeks, you've got 1 week, now we're forcing it out.
Okay.
But we're at 62% deployed, so by the time we get to those last people.
And that's always the case.
Those last people are going to be people you have to force anyways.
Right.
Yeah, we'll most likely use the no restart command line switch. So
that's the key. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. For those last people, we'll flip the install so it's a no restart, and then the next time they reboot, they'll go, "What's happening?" And they'll call the help desk and they'll go, "Did you read all the email? No, you didn't send me any email." Yeah. That's because you delete with a rule everything that you get from IT. Not to say anybody has ever seen that, but
okay, thank you.
Great. Did you have a question? No.
You mentioned drivers quite a few times, and one of my big problems with Windows 7 was having MDT, I'd inject all the drivers, then have the device detect them correctly. So has that been significantly better with Windows 10, and do you have a single image that includes all of your drivers?
So we do have a single image that includes all of our drivers. We use the same technique that we've been using since Windows 7. It's not the technique that Microsoft will tell you about, but if you go to Johan or Mikhail's sessions, so Johan Arvid Mark and Mikhail Nystrom.
Is that the selection groups?
They are, yeah.
Yeah.
That is by far the best technique. It is bulletproof. So we do it, and our parent company, Accenture, 440,000 machines, they do it, and it's the only way to go.
And so you do that, so you're deploying actually from MDT, or you're setting that up as an ISO, and then it's detecting it correctly as it builds.
So everything is on the ISO. Okay. So if you think the output from MDT is quote unquote an ISO, right? It can be WDS, booted, whatever, right? So all the drivers are on the ISO.
Right.
But the only ones that MDT injects are the ones that match the hardware that it detects. So we have exact control over what drivers get laid down and then detected.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. So we're going to stick around for a couple of minutes if there's any other questions. But other than that, thank you so much for attending. Appreciate it.